Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. We're here for our oral arguments, and I see we have the attorneys for the first case, which is Dean against Wexford Health Sources and others. A couple of docket numbers, 23058, 23139. And before we begin, let me just assure you that if we run into technological glitches, we will make whatever accommodations are necessary for the timing of people's arguments, but hopefully there will be no such glitches. And so we are ready when you are ready, Mr. Eden, to hear from you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Tim Eaton, and I represent the defendant's appellants. Your Honors, this case was supposed to be about whether defendant's treatment of plaintiff's renal cancer was unnecessarily delayed because the defendant physicians believed that when plaintiff went to sick call for a painless hematuria in late December 2015, his condition was a manifestation of his recurrent kidney problems, which he'd been experienced in 2003, in which he'd been treated for a while in prison rather than early signs of renal cancer.
So Mr. Eden, it would be helpful for me, at least, if as you present your argument, you make it clear which points you're making that pertain to the two individual doctors, Dr. Nawur and Dr. Einwohner, and which points pertain to Wexford itself, because obviously the jury drew quite a distinction between the individual doctors on the one side and the company on the other side in its punitive damage award. And at least it seems to me the arguments are slightly different.
I'd be happy to do that, Your Honor. So when I referred to the fact that there was an issue as to whether or not certain physicians of Wexford treated him properly at the beginning, I was referring to Dr. Nawur because he saw him on December 23rd, 2015. Dr. Einwohner, on the other hand, had been treating him since 2014 for a kidney problem. And in fact, he had had a CT scan, which she had ordered in July of 2015 before he saw Dr. Nawur. So there had been a medical history. And the course of treatment, Dr. Nawur was the medical director at Taylorville. But Your Honors, once the district court admitted the Lippert reports into evidence, even just for notice purposes.
Mr. Eaton, can I ask you a question? I'm interested in these Lippert reports, of course.
Yes, sir.
And they came in ostensibly for the purpose of notice, but clearly they were argued, at least in my opinion, they were argued for the truth of what was in the reports. But was notice ever an issue in this case? Was it, now I look at the jury instructions and I understand that with respect to the Eighth Amendment claim against Wexford, the district judge instructed that the plaintiff had to prove that the lack of reasonable measures to treat the plaintiff's serious medical need was a known or obvious consequence of the application of the policy, which I think here was the collegial review policy. But was there ever, there's evidence of notice. Clearly, Dr. Nawur was a good witness for the plaintiff, quite frankly, and he talked quite a bit about dumping on Wexford. But was notice ever an issue in this case that would necessitate the Lippert report coming in for that purpose?
Yes, it was, Your Honor, and for this reason. There was no evidence presented by the plaintiff other than through Dr. Nawur's frustration and criticisms of the collegial review process that related to anyone other than this particular plaintiff. As a matter of fact, when Dr. Barnett, who was plaintiff's expert on collegial review, testified, he said that the process didn't work as applied to this plaintiff. So the issue of notice as to whether or not this policy had affected anyone else or had risen to the level of a constitutional deprivation was in play, and there was no other evidence other than the Lippert reports that perhaps this had been an issue anywhere else.
I wondered about that, though, Mr. Eden. It did seem to me that there was other testimony aside from the reports. And the other thing about the reports that concerns me from the point of view of your argument is that the trial court did issue a limiting instruction, and we give a great deal of deference to those limiting instructions. And so I'm not sure why this is the time to deviate from that rule.
Your Honor, I'm aware of the curative instruction, but I also know this court has found in certain cases that even where a jury has been instructed, the prejudice is so much that the curative instruction or jury instruction cannot overcome it. And in this case, I think this is one of those instances. And the reason
is what you're essentially arguing, I put this in a slightly broader context. People certainly do raise Rule 403 arguments, and they appropriately raise them before a district court who will then weigh the probative value for the legitimate purpose, here notice, against the prejudicial impact. That's another thing that we give tremendous deference to the district court on.
Your Honor, in this particular case, as I pointed out, as we pointed out in our brief, and as I will argue today, the difficulty with having notice, even with the instruction, is that the second Lippert report, which was also admitted for the purpose of notice, was written and issued in October 2018.
No, I understood that you made that argument, but I went back and looked at the second report, and the content simply says nothing has changed. And so it's not as though they were introducing new information that, of course, you know, Wexford had no reason and the doctors had no reason to know of something that hadn't happened yet. But in fact, the second report, the Puisis report, is complaining that nothing has happened, that we're still in the same situation we were when the Shansky report came out.
But Your Honor, the Puisis report reached an entirely different conclusion. As a matter of fact, when the court appointed Puisis, he said that you may arrive at different solutions or opinions than Shansky. You don't have to just follow up where he left off. And if you look at the Shansky report, Shansky was talking about scheduling off-site services. And in that recommendation, he's talking about you need a logbook to keep track of these services. You need to make sure the record keeping is accurate, et cetera. And he goes through various reasons why things should be done differently. Puisis rejects all of that, and his conclusion is it's a patient safety hazard and it should be abandoned. And that conclusion was a conclusion that the plaintiff's counsel mentioned six different times before this jury.
It didn't seem with the Shanky report, the 2014 report, that the portion that went to the jury addressed anything about the harm that collegial review might cause. It talked about the problems with it, but what went to the jury didn't go on to address harm, compared to the 2018 report, which made a very strong statement about the harm. Is that a fair characterization?
Yes. It wasn't until the 18 report where they suggested that it could be a safety hazard to the patient. And in terms of notice, to go back to Judge Kirsch's original question, was notice an issue? And it certainly was. We did not have notice when he was being treated between 2015 and 2017 that the process of scheduling offsite services was somehow a patient safety hazard. And
but is
the
that
other thing
something
about,
that could be, if the notice, and I've just talked about the 2014 report, because I think there's a significant issue with the 2018, but the 2014 report that was admitted on the question of notice, it was used in the conclusions talked about the delay. Isn't that something that an inference, a reasonable inference, could be drawn by the jury that there's a problem with this delay in terms of healthcare?
Your Honor, I think in terms of the issue of delay, Shansky had suggested ways in which the process could be improved. There was
I think what Judge St. Eve is asking is that the way the jury had to hear it? Obviously, we're here reviewing a jury verdict, and very understandably, I mean, some of your brief reads as though you are asking us to just be the jury and read the evidence differently, but I think the Shansky report logically could lead to the inference that what was happening was inadequate and that there that you were on notice that it was inadequate.
But, Your Honor, what Shansky said was that some institutions that we reviewed, there were problems, but not all. For example, there's a quote in the Shansky report that says, additionally, although some of the facilities were tracking these steps fairly conscientiously, others were not.
But wouldn't that be a weight issue, Mr. Eaton? Wouldn't that be a weight issue? Because the institution where Mr. Dean was, I think we all agree, was not at issue in the Shansky report. So putting it in for notice, wouldn't that be a weight question as to what impact the jury decided to draw from that in terms of notice?
In part, Your Honor, but as you know, as we stated in our brief, Taylorville was never mentioned or never examined.
And they said you brought that out during cross-examination.
I'm sorry?
I'm sorry. I think that was elicited, that fact that Taylorville was not part of this was elicited before the jury.
Right. The problem with using this for notice is that there is no way in which we could have challenged any of the assertions in that report, because they could not be, the authors of the report could not be cross-examined pursuant to the order that was entered when they were appointed.
But
so there's
you
no
challenge
way...
them, and didn't you challenge them through other witnesses? I know you could not call the expert who wrote the report, Shansky, as a witness, and my guess is you may not have wanted to. But didn't you challenge the conclusions and the information that was used for notice through other witnesses?
There was only one witness who testified to it, Your Honor, and as counsel pointed out in their brief, the court decided to admit them for notice purposes on the fifth day of the seven-day trial. It was when our principal witness on collegial review, Dr. Ritz, was on the stand, and he was asked by counsel, have you heard of these reports? And he said, yes. He wasn't asked when he heard about the Pusis report. He was being questioned in 2019. He didn't say he was aware of it, obviously, prior to that time. And he said he disagreed with some of the conclusions. That was the
extent. The district court didn't preclude you in any limine rulings or otherwise from calling other witnesses to challenge the information in these reports, did it?
Or to challenge the fact that there was that this information had been placed in front of Wexford and thus it knew, again, sticking to notice, never mind the truth of the matter, which I don't think we should spill over into, but was Wexford aware that this was afoot, basically? And it seems that a rational jury could think yes.
Wexford certainly would have been aware of the Shansky report which was issued in 2014. Wexford was not a party at the time it was issued. In fact, Wexford was not a party when Dr. Shansky was first appointed in that case. However, in the 2000-
But Wexford was performing, Wexford has been the contracting agency for the prisons for quite some time.
They have been, but there was more to that report than just Wexford. Obviously, the only Department of Corrections was the defendant in the Wexford, in the focus on the Lippert reports. They also criticized IDOC for overcrowding, had nothing to do with Wexford, for certain conditions at the prison in terms of scheduling and in terms of the size of the room where they had sick call in, nothing to do with Wexford. So there were a lot of conclusions that related only to IDOC only and not to Wexford. And so again, I am not suggesting to this court that the Shansky report or even the Pusis report could never be used for notice purposes. I'm just stating that in this particular instance, I think it was inappropriate because also Judge St. Eve, to your question, were we precluded from putting on any other witnesses? This was the fifth day of the trial. We didn't know whether the court was going to allow Lippert in as notice. In fact, It had never happened before. I think this is the only case to date where Lippert has been admitted in evidence for any reason, even for notice.
So you're saying that you got to the fifth day of the trial without any consideration on your part or in pretrial orders about the use of the Lippert reports?
Well, it has certainly been raised as an issue because we filed a motion in limine, but it was not ruled upon till the very day of Dr. Ritz's testimony. And we asked a few questions about it. We had no opportunity to prepare him if it was coming in for the truth or for notice. And so
I don't understand how you say you had no, I mean, if you had the motion in limine, you haven't gotten the ruling yet. Wouldn't you have been prepared for it to come in either way, you know, on notice, for the truth, you know, any other permissible ground?
Well, Your Honor, I think, as I just stated, where it had never been permitted before, and in rather strong language by other courts and district courts, where they said that it shouldn't come in because of its highly prejudicial value to juries. In fact, there had been, subsequent to this case, there was a federal magistrate that said it was so highly prejudicial, couldn't be subject to cross-examination, that it shouldn't come in for any reason, because in the way it was being used, and I is to show the truth of it, even though there's this curative instruction, and I know Your Honor said they were instructed, but it would not make any sense if it was notice only for plaintiff's counsel to repeatedly refer to the conclusion in Puccius that it was a safety hazard and to indicate 10 different times with Dr. Ritz and in closing that these were independent experts as opposed to experts that are being called in litigation. And so that certainly shaded over into the matter of the truth. And furthermore, in order to show that the process of collegial review constitutes deliberate indifference, there are two showings they have to make. One, they have to show some type of systemic deficiencies, which I contend they did not, other than to this particular plaintiff, because that's what the testimony related to. And secondly, that they were on notice. They tried to use Lippert for both. And that was a problem with this case.
Can I just ask you one question about the deliberate indifference standard? As I understand the plaintiff's arguments, you know, essentially the problem with collegial review is that Wexford was using it as one size fits all. And, you know, so if somebody, you know, breaks his index finger, you know, maybe you can wait a little bit, you know, or somebody, you know, just has a bad sore throat, maybe you can wait for a little bit. But if somebody has something risking metastatic cancer, and there's the CT scan, which finally happens months and months later, you know, just sort of this casual one size fits all could be seen by a jury as objectively deliberately indifferent. And then you have to talk to people about whether they were implementing it in a deliberately indifferent way. And the jury heard testimony to that effect. The jury might have ruled for you. I don't think this case is at all easy in that sense, but the jury chose to rule for the other side.
Your Honor, on April 14th, when Dr. Severino, who was the outside urologist, performed the CT scan and found the cancer and notified the prison, he said it was non-emergent. And if it had been something that was other than non-emergent, yes, collegial review would not have applied. They were treating it as if it were a kidney stone problem based on his medical history, which I don't think is so far out of the bounds of professional judgment to plan a course of treatment based upon his...
You had testimony to that effect, but wasn't there evidence on the other side that given the amount of blood and blood clots and so on, it was outside the scope of medical judgment not to ask for the CT scan sooner, to just stay with the ultrasound?
Your Honor, I don't believe they said it was outside the scope of medical judgment. What they said was a breach of the standard of care. And medical malpractice does not equate necessarily to deliberate indifference. It's not a federal right. And there was a state count on medical malpractice, which the jury decided against the two Wexford physicians, Navar and Ann Vonner. We're not challenging that on the facts. We're thinking that Lippert so prejudiced that finding that we should be entitled to a new trial on that as well. But on this is not an Eighth Amendment, and not every medical malpractice case arises to the denial of a federal right.
Mr. Eaton, I want to go back to what you said a moment ago about deliberate indifference and the proving up of a systemic issue. So
yes.
What's at issue here is the policy of collegial review. And we said recently in the Howell case that the collegial review policy is not unconstitutional on its face.
Yes.
So that alone is not sufficient to establish deliberate indifference. The case law is a little bit murky as to exactly what is required to establish institutional deliberate indifference based on a policy that on its face is not unconstitutional. So what exactly under our case law is required to meet that deliberate indifference standard for the institution?
Your Honor, I first have to agree it's not entirely clear. In the Hildreth case, where it was dealing with whether or not the inmate was getting his prescription medicines, a majority of the court found that there was no widespread deficiency with respect to that issue. And there were at least, I think, three different times where he didn't receive his prescriptions. So the issue is not clear cut. In Howell, I think the court was influenced by the fact that there'd been an outside medical doctor who had said that he didn't think the ACL surgery was necessary. So I think you have to look at the facts and the medical judgment that was issued. But by the way, Dr. Severino, who inherited this case, or took over this case, I should say, on March 10th, approximately three months after he'd initially gone in with this problem, the sick call. At that point in time, he took charge of getting ready for the surgery. And he said, and when he testified, and he was not sued, that I'm not going to rush this thing because I don't want him to die on the table. I'm going to line up the people I need to have a successful surgery. And by all accounts, it was. It was 9-hour surgery, 9 different physicians. There was a suggestion that his life expectancy may be 3 years, he's still alive. I mean, there's all sorts of things. You have to look at the totality, I think, of the circumstances here in terms of his care.
There but was back also to deliberate indifference, back to the deliberate indifference standard.
Yes.
If, assuming plaintiff had sufficient evidence to show that the collegial review process as to Mr. Dean resulted in poor medical care, or that he can meet that standard as to the collegial review process, what, since it's not unconstitutional on its face, what more is required under the law for the plaintiff to prove? And I'm looking at some of our prior cases, Davis versus Carter being one of them, where we talked about establishing the widespread customer policy, that you don't have to show that the policy at issue routinely interfered or caused Eighth Amendment problems for other inmates, that you just have to show that the policy applied to other inmates. So is it enough if they can show that this policy caused the care issues for Mr. Dean, plus this policy was widespread at the institution? Or is there something more? And if it's something more, what is it?
I think as this court said in Howell, when they were talking about the effort of the plaintiff in that case to get 4 affidavits from other inmates who had had similar issues to Mr. Howell, I think they were complaining about physical therapy, as I recall. And the court said something more needed to be done to show that this policy in that case, whether or not how they were treated, was enough. There should have been some evidence, it seems to me, by Mr. Dean, that collegial review had caused problems with other inmates other than just in this one instance. And by the way, plaintiff's expert on collegial review said, I'm not opposed to the policy. In fact, we use it in California. What I am testifying to is as it was applied to Mr. Dean, it was deficient. And the jury found that they violated the standard of care by awarding money in the medical malpractice case. The question, which I know you're asking, is at what point does that arise to an Eighth Amendment violation? And I would say it has to be more than just an individual who they may have not met the standard of care, but it's not something that's a widespread deficiency. And I think that was the prejudice by the Lippert report, because that seems to try to fill in that gap that there had been other instances of it. Your Honors, I see I have about 5 minutes left, and I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
That would be fine. Thank you, Mr. Eaton. Mr. Martin.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Craig Martin. Let me begin here with regard to the conversation that you all were just having. There was a deliberate indifference instruction. That instruction was not challenged by the defendant, not objected to, and any challenge to it would be waived on appeal.
Mr. Martin, can I ask you a question regarding that instruction?
Yes.
There is no issue with the instruction. The issue seems to me after Howell, but I'm interested in your take on Howell, the conflating of, and this is where it becomes sort of a matter of law, in my opinion, under the deliberate indifference standard, the conflating of the standard of care and deliberate indifference. And your closing argument, which was, it was very effective. I'm not being critical of it at all, but it does repeatedly conflate the standard of care with the policy and with an argument of medical indifference. And it could certainly have left the jury with the impression that an Eighth Amendment violation occurs when the defendants violate the standard of care. And what I'm really interested in here is the role that the outside experts played here, the outside doctors, because what we wrote in Howell, as Judge St. Eve said, policy is not unconstitutional on its face, but there's a paragraph that talks about the medical treatment was consistent with the medical advice from the outside orthopedic surgeon. And then it says, this exercise of medical judgment by the outside specialist makes it difficult at best to show that Wexford's delay in going through with the surgery amounted to deliberate indifference to Howell's serious medical needs. Distinguishing between the standard of care and total indifference to medical judgment does not equal, standard of care does not equal deliberate indifference. So explain that to me in the context of your closing argument, and explain the context and what was the jury supposed to understand here in terms of how do they not conflate standard of care and medical indifference in this trial?
Well, I don't think that they do. And I think there's a short answer and there's probably a longer answer to your question. The short answer is that a properly instructed jury with regard to the evidence that is before it interpreted the facts, weighed the evidence, and made a conclusion. There was nothing, as Your Honor pointed out, there was nothing improper about that instruction on deliberate indifference. It captured the law accurately. There was no objection to it, and it is waived. Now, as a practical matter, with respect to the theoretical legal question, deliberate indifference has an element of consciousness to it that regular negligence would not, or standard of care would not. So it's the element of consciousness that is really what gets you into deliberate indifference. And then taking it, Your Honor, this is the longer answer now, taking it to the facts of this case. With respect to the facts of this particular case, there is a short version and a longer version, and I'm going to give you both. The short version is that you have Dr., in particular, Dr. Noor's testimony. And the testimony of Dr. Nuwar is he's been there for a long time. He's been doing this for a long time. And Dr. Nuwar repeatedly talks about collegial review, how decisions are always made in Pittsburgh, how he cannot do things the way he would want to do things, the way he would do things in private practice, and talks about the delays of collegial review and the costs associated with collegial review. And Dr. Nuwar's testimony, if you take a look at it, is quite colorful with regard to that, giving the jury not only conscious disregard with regard to this particular individual, Mr. Dean, but giving the jury enough evidence to make a very reasonable inference that there's conscious indifference with regard to all inmates subject to this same policy because of the way Wexford applies it. That's Dr. Nuwar's testimony. With regard to this particular case, we presented to the jury that there was, I think, 24 instances of collegial review prior to the time he had his surgery. 24. We presented to the jury that took 207 days from December of 2015 until he had his surgery.
What was the exact delay in his treatment that was caused by the collegial review process? I mean, he had all these collegial reviews that were approved and he got the treatment, and I don't think you could start back from December because the collegial review process didn't kick in until January. December, we're talking about a medical judgment on the part of Dr. Nuwar. We're not talking about collegial review. So from the time the collegial review started in January or was recommended in January, what exactly was it about that review that caused the delay in Mr. Dean's care?
Okay, so let me go through the evidence a little bit on collegial review generally and get to that particular point in time. The evidence on collegial review at trial, let me frame it out first. Going into the trial, here's where we stood on, and I'll get there, but going into trial, here's where we stood on collegial review. The witnesses in 30B6 depositions from Wexford had testified that they knew nothing about Mr. Dean's collegial reviews, no memories whatsoever, okay? They also testified, and they did this at trial, that 85 to 90% of collegial reviews were completely perfunctory, and meaning that they served no medical purpose or no peniological purpose. Then, with regard to documents, the document production on collegial review was late and was sloppy, and the court said that during the trial while she was ruling. And in terms of the document review, just to frame out the issues, the document review came on, there was a document review that came on Friday before a Monday trial, which caused there's a lot of energy about, and I'll come back and talk about that more with regard to Lippert. Then when you get to the timeline that we're talking about here, on December 23rd, 2015, Mr. Dean goes to Dr. Nuwar, presents with gross hematuria. Dr. Nuwar tells him it's either cancer or kidney stones, and he testifies at trial that he should go see a urologist. That's what his opinion was. That gets sent to collegial review. And it doesn't get sent to collegial review in a very timely manner. The collegial review ultimately takes place, I think, on January 13th, 2016. And that by that time, he has also seen by video, just like we're doing here today, he's seen by video the nephrologist, Dr. Einwohner. And Dr. Einwohner testifies and talks about how you see a urologist and you get a scan. You get a CAT scan. Right? So that's the testimony from Einwohner. And she sends an email to Dr. Ritz saying that this should go to collegial review. He gets to collegial review. There's no real testimony or any evidence with regard to what is discussed, who is there, nothing meaningful. All you know is they come out of collegial review and they don't send him to a urologist and they don't send him to a to go get a CAT scan.
But Mr. Martin, some of that had to do with the fact that the ultrasound was misread, right? I mean, the problem I'm having here is with an Eighth Amendment violation, the timeline, your client goes on 2015, he sees the doctor. On January 13th, there's a collegial review. They decide on an ultrasound. So the doctors do exercise some medical judgment, even if they're wrong, and even if other doctors disagree with them, they exercise medical judgment. He has the ultrasound on February 2nd, and the ultrasound is misread. And so everything changes based on the radiologist who misreads the ultrasound. And that changes things. And then on March 10th, Dr. Severino gets involved. And doesn't Howell have some role to play once Dr. Severino gets involved on March 10th?
No, Your Honor. And with respect to, well, let me start with your timeline and the presumption of your question.
And if you could, at some point in there, Mr. Martin, you still haven't answered my earlier question. I think it links up with what Judge Kirsch is asking you about. What was the delay in his treatment that was caused by the collegial review process that resulted in his injury? There were, you've talked about flaws in the collegial review process, and I think we can all agree that that process has its kinks and could be run better, but that's not enough for deliberate indifference against an institution. You have to show that that collegial review process, the policy at issue, is what caused his injury here. And I still am not sure what your theory is on that versus the standard of care being a problem.
Well, with regard to the, I'll take the very first collegial review. With regard to the collegial review, the standard of care at that time is urologist, send him to a urologist and go ahead and get a CAT scan. They
but
go
isn't
to collegial
it,
review.
Wasn't the testimony, and didn't Dr. Eiwenauer say, get the imaging and then go to the urologist? Because the urologist isn't going to be able to do anything without the imaging. So I don't recall, and correct me if I'm wrong, I don't recall any expert coming in saying that it was deliberately indifferent or beyond any acceptable standard that you would get the ultrasound or whatever imaging is ordered first before going to the urologist. And you need some type of expert testimony, I think, if that's your theory, to show that that alone was beyond what was acceptable in the medical profession.
So I think Dr. Darr is the expert that gives you that testimony, who's the urologist that testifies, and she testifies as to the standard of care. And the standard of care is to go to a urologist and get a CAT scan. And that is what Eiwenauer essentially testifies to and what Noir testifies to.
But that's a difference than the point you just raised. That is what imaging should have been done, not should you have gotten the imaging before or after seeing the urologist, because you were arguing before it was a problem that they didn't immediately send him to a urologist. And I didn't see any expert saying, well, you have to go to the urologist before the imaging is performed.
So, no, I don't think anybody breaks it down in terms of that timing.
Can I just add to that? I thought your argument, and maybe I was misreading, was that based on your outside expert's testimony, that the first step should have been, and it was indeed deliberately indifferent, for the first step to be an ultrasound as opposed to a CT scan. The CT scan was going to show what needed to be shown, yes or no. I mean, who knew? But that was actually an embedded problem by the time the technician reports no evidence of cancer. Ultrasounds just don't show things the way CT scans do.
So, Judge Wood, you've stated it more clearly than I did. That is That is what the argument is. The standard of care is not to go get an ultrasound. The standard
but
of care.
But again, we're talking about negligence. When we talk about standard of care, we're talking about negligence. I understand that. But the question is, what is deliberately indifferent? What is the total lack of medical judgment? She didn't send him for an x-ray on his foot. She sent him for an ultrasound. That is the exercise of medical judgment. Even if that isn't the right test, there is testimony that injecting dye in somebody of his with his comorbidities 6 months after they just injected him with dye and didn't find any cancer, there's some risk to that. And maybe the better course of treatment is to do an ultrasound first, which, by the way, should have caught the cancer. I think we all agree with that, right?
I don't know if we do all agree with that.
No, we don't agree with that.
We don't agree
that the ultrasound...
Wait, hold on. We don't agree with what? That the ultrasound should have caught the cancer?
Correct.
The ultrasound does not rule in or rule out cancer. It can show mass. That is why it is not the standard of care.
Okay.
Go
ahead. I'm talking about the specific ultrasound in this case. I thought there was testimony that the ultrasound in this case showed the cancer. And it's a 50% chance it might show it and a 50% chance it might not.
If it had been read correctly.
The ultrasound is not the standard of care, and the ultrasound doesn't show cancer or rule out cancer. That's the evidence in this case.
So Mr. Martin, let me maybe try to, since time flees quickly. It is certainly true, and we all know, I'm sure you would concede, that simply showing a failure to meet the standard of care doesn't get you all the way home to an Eighth Amendment violation. It's probably also true that every time you can show deliberate indifference and the right kind of causation embedded in there, there's also a problem of standard of care. But focusing here, I think what you need to tell us is why did the repeated use, maybe it's not even just one time, why did the repeated use of collegial review constitute something that a rational jury could see as Wexford's adoption of a deliberately indifferent policy, not one that would responsibly discharge its duties as the medical providers?
So collegial review in this case, with regard to the multiple times of collegial review that went on, there is no record evidence, and the jury concluded what it concluded, but there's no record evidence that there's any medical discussion that goes on during collegial review.
So you're saying a jury could have viewed, first of all, I think you're saying that we can't just look at one instance or another instance of collegial review. We have to look at it as a policy of Wexford. And secondly, I think you're saying that the evidence in front of the jury permitted it to conclude that it just builds lots of delay into the system, unjustified from a medical point of view on this record.
Yes, and there's zero evidence in the record with regard to anyone testifying about any of the collegial reviews in this case. There's the 85 to 90% of collegial reviews are completely perfunctory. And there's also evidence that explains why they do that. So going back to that ultrasound versus CAT scan versus urologist issue, if Wexford sends Mr. Dean to a urologist or to a CAT scan, it comes out of Wexford's profit line. That's what the testimony was in the case. If they have an image, a urology image or an ultrasound image that goes on campus, if you will.
But they do that.
It's included in the contract. Go ahead.
They do that here. That's where I get hung up on the medical indifference. So he goes for an ultrasound. The ultrasound is misread. They then have a collegial review, and they decide to refer him to a urologist for what's called a cystoscopy. I don't know how to say it. And Mr. Martin, I don't think you do either. I read that in your closing arguments. Cystoscopy, I think, something like that. But then on March 10th, he sees the urologist, Dr. Severino, and then he gets a CT scan.
Right.
That's the problem I have from a medical indifference standpoint. How do we square that with Howell's, this exercise of medical judgment by the outside specialist, Dr. Severino, makes it difficult at best to show that Wexford's delay in going through with the surgery or the delay in getting to the surgery amounted to deliberate indifference to Dean's serious medical needs. How do we square what happens here once Severino gets involved with what happened in Howell?
Well, once Severino is involved, Severino starts moving it toward surgery, right? That's clear in the record.
Right.
And all of the points, Your Honor, that you're making here today were made in front of the jury for them to determine in a factual way. But when you're pre-Severino, the notion of going to a ultrasound as opposed to a urologist or a CAT scan, you can't assume or presume that there's some medical judgment that comes out of collegial review. The falsity of the collegial review story, which, by the way, was put into play at the very beginning of the case by the defendant when they said collegial review is essentially perfect and that it's baked into the contract, which it's not. There's no evidence that there's any meaningful medical judgment going on during collegial review.
And Mr. Martin, that might be correct. And again, the collegial review process looks like it has its issues. But just not having medical judgment exercised at the collegial review process can't be sufficient on its own to establish deliberate indifference. We know that the collegial review process itself, the policy itself, is not unconstitutional. So, and we also know here it looks like every request that went for collegial review was granted, that he received the treatment that the collegial review board reviewed for approval. They approved it, and he got it. So you have to show something more. You have to show that delay, whatever the delay was caused by, first of all, that it was a delay, and second, that it caused his injury here. And that's what I'm struggling with in light of some of the points that Judge Kirsch just pointed out. Dr. Serenino coming in, the misread film by an outside expert. What is your evidence that the outside collegial review, and which we can all agree is not perfect, that any delays caused by that actually caused the injury here?
So,
what's your evidence
to
support that? Rather than just saying, well, collegial review is bad, that can't be enough.
Okay, so collegial review serves no, point one, it serves no valid medical purpose. There is no evidence
that
these
sums...
And that
may be true, but again, that doesn't get you across the line because that's not unconstitutional by itself.
So are you arguing that whether you take it from January 13 or whether perhaps you take it from March 22nd when Dr. Severino's requests are considered in collegial review, you still don't wind up having the surgery until July 19th. And so there's a time factor there that the collegial review is imposing. And I also had a question for you. To what extent was the jury told about the economic incentives that you alluded to a moment ago? That, you know, Wexford, I guess they're paid on a capitation basis, right, for the number of prisoners. And so their economic incentive is not to provide care because it hits their profit line. The jury was told all of that?
Yes. The jury was told that each collegial review served no medical purpose and imposed delay. That delay, as I said earlier, took you from 207 days to 47 days. So that's the differential that was argued to the jury and the jury found. With regard to cost, there was extensive trial testimony with regard to cost, and it came in several different ways. The Wexford contract is a $1.3 billion contract over 10 years, about $133 million a year. The way the Wexford contract is structured and essentially the way it works is that they're paid to take care of the inmate population. Certain things are included in the contract, included in the fixed fee, if you will. If they do certain other things, it's on Wexford's nickel. It cuts into their profit margin. So, for example, the two things that are relevant in this case is going to a urologist and getting a CAT scan off campus come out of Wexford's profit margin. Urology or ultrasound on campus does not come out of their profit margin. There was also testimony in this case specific to Mr. Dean with respect to Wexford after his cancer surgery. After his cancer surgery, he went on chemotherapy drugs. And there's a whole line of cross-examination with regard to how Wexford does not want to give him expensive cancer medication drugs, $15,000 a month, and instead would prefer to have him on palliative care in order to save money.
This is the comment they wanted him in hospice, right?
Right, palliative care, hospice.
So the jury might have seen that as deliberate corporate indifference.
And there was collegial review during that process, too, that had no medical purpose and just injected delay to his chemotherapy.
Mr. Martin, before we get to the post-surgery, can we talk about the Lippert reports for 1 minute? Because I have some questions about the Lippert reports, particularly the second report and the relevance of the report. And again, your closing argument is very effective on the reports. This is very, very bad evidence for Wexford. And you point that out effectively in your closing arguments, particularly pages 13, 11, and 13, 12, where you talk about Dr. I don't know how to say his name, P-U-I-S-I-S, and his team, and you talk about how they're an independent expert, and they go in and they determine that collegial review is a patient safety hazard and should be abandoned until patient safety is ensured. And then you remind the jury that they're going to have these reports in the jury room with them. What was the relevance of the 2018 report under a strict 401 analysis?
The relevance with regard to the two reports, both Shansky and the subsequent Puist report, I think is the way you say it, is that it is relevant to Wexford, first relevant to Wexford's notice of the problems with collegial review.
I don't think you can combine the two reports, because that's a fair argument on the 2014 report. But the 2018 report came after the fact, came after the events here that you're claiming Wexford was deliberately indifferent for. So how could that possibly be relevant to notice if it was created and issued after what they were supposedly on notice of?
Yeah, well, the words of that report itself, I agree with you. With respect to the report and the ongoing report, Dr. Ritz, for example, was deposed in 2018 in that case. He knew about what was going on in the Lippert case.
In 2018, the events in question here took place before that. The Puist report was issued after the events here. So how could that possibly put Wexford on notice?
Well, the events here, just to make sure we do the timeline, the events go all the way into 2017 with regard to the cancer drugs and so forth.
Well, except that the report was 2018. That's after the event, and I think the last collegial review was sometime in 2016, late 2016. So how could the 2018 report possibly put Wexford on notice of anything relevant to the events as to Mr. Dean?
So is it the report that put Wexford on notice? Or is it the content? You know, if there was a sentence in the report, just to make it too obvious, in which it said, in 2016, Wexford knew that collegial review rarely changed outcomes and was a waste of time, period. Well, that would be some evidence that Wexford, that somebody thought that anyway at Wexford. Whether you take that for the truth or not is the next difficult question. But do you have to get into the contents of the report, or is it the existence of the report itself that creates the notice?
Well, I think it's the contents of the report that create the notice as you go along, and Wexford is deeply involved in both of those reports.
But if this wasn't issued in 2018, how can the content put Wexford on notice?
Well, it's the content that they're actually going through that investigation because they're actually deposed in it. And in fact, you know, to be quite blunt about it, their trial counsel misled the court about whether they were a party in that litigation initially. So with regard to those reports, the reports put them on notice, but there's one, I only have a minute left, and there's one other point with regard to the reports that I want to make sure is not lost, and that is in our brief, we point out that not only, let me say it like this, the reports with regard to collegial review are relevant and noticed to the way Wexford actually presented the evidence to the jury. Wexford came to the trial and said that collegial review was a perfect system. They had their witnesses testify that it was a perfect system, and their witnesses knew that it was not. And that issue not only goes to did they open the door, but it also goes to the award of
But the question damages. Is going to be whether or not the witnesses knew that at the time Mr. Dean was going through his process. And the findings from the 2018 report that were admitted that were quite different from the findings in the 2014 report weren't issued until 2018 after Mr. Dean had had all of the treatments at issue in this case. I don't know how that could possibly put Wexford on notice, because what was admitted before the jury wasn't information about what was going on to reach the conclusion. The finding that the collegial review process was a patient safety hazard and should be abandoned was issued and presented before the jury. I don't know how that possibly could have put Wexford on notice back in 2016 of anything.
Well, right. So I'll just stick with the prior answer that I've given with regard to that, and it is the contents of the report, and Wexford is involved in them. And I'd encourage you to look at Dr. Ritz's testimony on it.
I did, but that's a conclusion. That is a specific finding, and I didn't see anything in Dr. Ritz's testimony or anybody else's that they were aware in 2016 of that specific finding. And I think that's your notice problem.
Right. Well, he does not give a time frame for what notice he has of different things and when in that testimony, and no one further examines him other than me.
But the report and the finding wasn't issued until 2018. So I think I don't know how you could argue otherwise without testimony suggesting that.
So I'll prolong this another second and certainly adjust for Mr. Eden as well. But that's why I wanted to know about the contents, because if the contents said, for example, you know, on July 1st, 2016, Wexford received a complaint about something or other. I mean, that would be some evidence that Wexford had been told about things. So that's why I'm wondering whether, again, the focus isn't does a 2021 report tell Wexford anything about what happened in 2016? Certainly not. But if that's not how you were trying to use it, then it's a different proposition.
The record does not have that evidence in it. It does not. The second report is backward looking for sure and examining things after the first report was issued in 2014, but the record does not have in it as it is right now that in 2015 these events occurred. But that is the time frames that they're examining, 2015, 2016, and so forth, coming up with that report.
But
so that's
report,
why I go back
again,
to the content.
Is not what was admitted before the jury. Was not factual information about what they were looking at in 2016. It is the doctor's finding and opinion that the collegial review process is a patient safety hazard.
Right, I understand the point. The other, if I may just make the last point, in our briefs we argue, and we argued at trial, that these reports were admissible under Rule 807. As the most reliable evidence with regard to collegial review. And if you'll give me one moment to just quickly explain that. With regard to collegial review, as I said, Dr. Ritz and the others from Wexford testified that they had zero memory of any collegial review. 85% to 90% of them were perfunctory. The document production in the case came late. it was sloppy, and you could conclude that it's either they either created documents and didn't produce them, they created documents and destroyed them, or they never created documents. There was ample evidence with regard to all the documents of to evidence collegial review that would have been created had they followed their policy.
And there's different... Mr. Martin, 807 is a hearsay rule, and it's the residual exception that puts that looks at the trustworthiness of the underlying documents. It's not a sanction for a discovery abuse or a bad behavior in discovery. I have never seen, and I looked at this, any court use Rule 807 as a sanction for discovery abuse. And in fact, that would seem to undermine the whole purpose of Rule 807, which is to admit hearsay that has some underlying trustworthiness to it.
Right. The reason I set it up.
You're making a Rule 37 argument, which should have been made to the district court during discovery.
Your Honor, I agree with your point, but there were two motions going on at the beginning of the trial. One was to exclude the Lippert reports. The other was actually a discovery motion based on the sanctions, essentially, and asking for an adverse inference because of the failure to produce evidence. The reason I set it up like that.
Not a sanctions rule. 807 right. Is a trustworthiness issue.
Exactly. And I agree. And the reason I set it up like that is because in the context of this trial, the most reliable evidence with regard to collegial review was could be viewed as the Lippert reports. What you had is you had very ample and full evidence from each of the doctors testifying about collegial review. And then you essentially had the complete absence, a memory void, if you will, from Wexford. And you didn't have, you know, except the take it as true that the documents that they were supposed to create, they never created. In that environment, under Rule 807, those documents should come in as an exception to the hearsay rule because they are corroborated by the testimony that's at trial and they are reliable evidence by a Rule 706 expert appointed by a court. So those could have been admitted for the full purpose under Rule 807. That's my point.
All right, I think we'll have to leave it there, Mr. Martin, and we will give Mr. Eden another 8 minutes for his rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would like to address a couple points that you all have asked about. First of all, with respect to collegial review and whether it had any value, there were two witnesses that testified that, in fact, it did. One was Dr. Barnett, who was the plaintiff's expert, and he said, if you follow the guidelines, it works. In fact, he also said, cost-effective medicine is safe medicine.
But that's a jury issue, correct, Mr. Eden? There was evidence on the other side. If that were the only evidence about it, your argument would be persuasive here. But there was plenty of evidence on the other side for the jury to come out otherwise.
Your Honor, I agree with respect to how it was applied in this case. There was other evidence. As to how it was applied in other cases, there was not. And I think to show deliberate indifference, they would need to show that.
Mr. Eaton, you emphasized this in your brief too, the quote that you just gave us, cost-effective medicine is good medicine. But that seems wildly over-inclusive to me. It sounds like you would never give anybody, you know, medications or surgical interventions if you could just put them in hospice on palliative care and save a lot of money and, you know, give them enough painkillers that they're not bothered and let them quietly pass away. And that's not the way we run our medical system. So, I mean, it just seems over-inclusive. Sometimes, of course, we don't want people to have unnecessary tests. We don't want people to waste money. But cost-effective medicine is good medicine is over-inclusive.
Your Honor, I agree if it's stated broadly, but it was coming from an expert for the plaintiff that had been involved in California prison system for some time. In fact, I think worked within that system, and he was talking about the pluses. Counsel has said several different times during the argument today that it served absolutely no purpose at all. And his own, the only witness that he had that was a medical witness on his side to say that it wasn't a good policy, didn't say that. He thought it was, but he did say, as applied in this case, which goes to the standard of care, Dr. Ritz, of course, said he thought it was a good policy. And then there's Dr. Nawar, who counsel, and I'm sure he misspoke, said that he had been there for a long time and he witnessed how it worked and it didn't work. Actually, he started on December 2nd, 2015, 3 weeks before he saw the plaintiff. So his opinion, I think, and again, I know I'm getting Mr. into issues of weight.
Mr. Eaton, doesn't the Howell case teach us that the collegial review policy is not unconstitutional on its face? So the only way in which it's unconstitutional is as applied. There's two ways in which it can be applied unconstitutionally. One is if you have a comparator or you have certain comparators. The other way is if it's just applied as to the plaintiff in an unconstitutional way to lead to deliberate indifference, which is what the judge instructed here when she said there was a known and obvious consequence of the application to the plaintiff of the policy described in paragraph 2. So you don't necessarily have to have a comparator to establish an Eighth Amendment violation in these cases after Howell. Is that correct, or do you disagree with me on that?
I disagree with you slightly, Your Honor. I think Howell did not make it absolutely clear that just a few instances would be sufficient to show that there was deliberate indifference. As to how many times you would need, I think this was addressed by actually Judge Hamilton in his dissent in Hildreth, and I think it's unclear, but what he said in Hildreth in his dissent, it means that the plaintiff is going to have to find evidence that it applies to more than just his particular situation. It has to go beyond that. And
well,
I think,
you know, we also need to factor in our in-bank decision in the JKJ case. If it's a general policy, as I say, you know, if it's just sort of a we always do things slowly policy, there are going to be some instances in which that doesn't cause harm to a person because they have a condition that can take a wait and see approach. If they applied that policy to somebody with an urgent medical problem, however, then it would be a problem. And just adopting the one size fits all might be the deliberate indifference. It seems to me,
and
that's what
Your Honor, I don't disagree that there couldn't be an instance where that one instance that would apply where it could be deliberate indifference. But here there was
flowing
no
flowing from the policy, right? Flowing
right,
from the,
right.
You know, we always do this pointless collegial review, you know, sort of touch that base. And as Howell said, it's not necessarily always terrible. On its face is a very high standard to meet, by the way. The on its face standard means there isn't a single application of that policy that can be justified.
But I don't think there's any evidence here, and this perhaps goes back to Judge St. Eve's questions, that the collegial review process here is what caused the delay. The initial collegial review was on January 13th after Dr. Einwander had recommended that there be one and said, I think this is an issue involving his kidney stones, and then gave several recommendations. If it hadn't been for the fact that the ultrasound was misread, there actually, it did show a mass, which was testified to by our radiologist at trial. So if it hadn't been misread, Dr. Nawar, and this is uncontradicted in his testimony, I would have been on a totally different trajectory.
No, he does say that. But what about the time from March 10, 2016, when Dr. Severino becomes involved? They do a collegial review for his requests a couple weeks later, March 22nd. Then they have to have another collegial review about the nephrectomy, and then they have another consult, another thing, and the surgery doesn't wind up happening until July 19th, and then we still have even more collegial reviews after that, fussing around with whether we're going to do chemotherapy. I mean, there's a built-in, every step is slow, and we have cases that say even a week of delay can be a problem.
Your Honor, I think this goes back.
By the time he has the surgery, his cancer has metastasized.
I think this goes back to Dr. Kirsch's. It's doctor.
Dr.
I'm sorry, Judge.
I'm not a doctor. That I'm not.
I have too many doctors here, Your Honor. Yes. I apologize. But you asked earlier, counsel, about the intersection between Howell and Dr. Severino. And I think there is an intersection there that needs to be addressed. Once it was in Dr. Severino's hands, who he determined, and he was an outside urologist, that it was a non-emergent situation. And he took control at that point, and there had been a number of collegial reviews that had been approved along the way, but there was absolutely no evidence that the delay caused in getting together a 9-person surgical team for a 9-hour surgery was caused by collegial review. It was, he wanted to get the best group of physicians together. So I think once he becomes involved, that absolutely is important to consider, both with respect to standard of review, which is standard of care, which the jury decided, and deliberate indifference.
Is that
a violation of a federal right?
Did Dr. Severino ever testify that there was harm that resulted from the collegial reviews after he got involved in the case? I know there was quite a bit of testimony from Dr. Severino that he needed to take things slow with respect to scheduling the surgery and putting the 10-person team together to ensure that Mr. Dean didn't die on the table, that it was a very involved and difficult surgery. But does Dr. Severino ever complain after March 10th, 2016, that collegial review resulted in some harm to Mr. Dean?
No.
Were there any experts who testified to that?
Your Honor, let me answer it this way. The plaintiff's expert was asked, and this was with respect to the delay initially. He said, and you have to consider, this is a question asked, as the treating physician, the patient's medical history when ordering a diagnostic test, right? Answer, you do. Question, and whether or not to order an ultrasound in a specific situation involves an exercise of clinical judgment, isn't that right? It sure does. Barnett says the same thing. So we're not talking about decisions here that were so far out of the realm of professional judgment when their own plaintiff's witnesses are saying, yeah, it involves clinical judgment. I disagree with it. It's not the standard of care. And then specifically to Your Honor's question, there was testimony about what harm delay caused from December 23rd to July 19th, when I think the surgery is. And there was testimony that, yes, they believe that that harmed him. That was not Dr. Severino's testimony. And that did not divide the time between December 23rd and when Dr. Severino first got involved on March 10th.
All right, I think we'll leave it there. We appreciate the efforts of both counsel. The court will take the case under advisement.